I want you to picture a scenario that is, well, it's probably painfully familiar to you.
Oh, I think we all have a few of those.
Right. So you're sitting on hold with your health insurance provider. You're listening to that same like loop of tinny, royalty-free elevator music for the fifth time, trying to figure out why a critical medication was denied.
Yeah, the absolute worst.
And as the minutes tick by, you get this dark kind of sinking feeling. It's the sudden realization that the system on the other end of the phone, it wasn't actually built to heal you.
No, not at all.
Or, maybe you've had this feeling looking at the news, like watching the stock market soar to absolute record highs, hearing about this explosive economic growth, and then you go to the grocery store.
And you get the receipt.
Yes, you realize your weekly food bill has just doubled. You stand there in the aisle and think, wait, who is this economy actually for? Because it really doesn't seem to be for me.
Right, it feels completely disconnected.
So if you have ever felt that way, I need you to know something right from the jump. You aren't crazy.
You really aren't. And honestly, it is a profound relief to finally see that pervasive gnawing feeling articulated, not just as a passing complaint about modern life, but as a formal systemic diagnosis.
Yeah, because we spend so much time internalizing those frictions, don't we?
We do.
Yeah,
We totally do. We tell ourselves it's just, our fault for not understanding the bureaucracy or that it's just the inevitable cost of doing business in a complex world.
we really just brush it off. But today we are going to look at a piece of work that completely validates that friction. I mean, it argues that the feeling of being crushed by the very institutions meant to serve you, that isn't a glitch.
No, it's the defining feature.
Exactly. It's the defining feature of our modern civilization. And far more importantly, we're going to explore a blueprint for how we might actually begin to fix it.
Which is so desperately needed. So the foundation for our conversation today is this really fascinating academic white paper from June 2026.
Yeah, let's get into the source.
It's titled Toward a Life Coherent Commons. And the author is Dr. Bechara Sahili. He's a physician and a public health thinker based in St. Kitts and Nevis down in the Caribbean.
Right.
And what makes this document so remarkable is just its scope. I mean, it is a capstone synthesis.
It really is massive.
Yeah, Dr. Sahili isn't just looking at like a broken healthcare system and offering a few policy tweaks. He is pulling together threads from law, from finance, medicine, artificial intelligence, global governance,
She's everything.
right, to reveal a single underlying disorder that is infecting all of them simultaneously.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because our mission for this deep dive is to take this really dense philosophical framework for what he calls civilizational repair and figure out how it applies to our actual lived reality. Like,
Exactly.
how do we take these runaway institutions that seem to have developed a mind of their own and re-nest them back into serving, breathing human life?
That framing is crucial because Dr. Sahili is very careful not to present this as just a simple list of grievances.
Why, it's not just complaining.
No, he isn't writing a manifesto to just tear down capitalism or vilify doctors and lawyers and engineers. Instead, he provides a lens.
A way of seeing things.
Yeah, he calls it a way to see the hidden inversions operating in our daily lives. And I'm telling you, once you understand the pattern he's describing, you will never walk into a hospital or a school or a bank and see them the exact same way again.
No, you really won't. So the core of this entire framework starts with a concept he calls the Great Inversion.
Right.
And the premise is both simple and honestly terrifying. It argues that the instruments and systems humanity created to serve life have quietly become sovereign over it.
The word sovereign does a lot of heavy lifting there.
Oh, totally.
Think about the fundamental nature of an instrument, right? A tool is by definition subordinate to the person using it and the purpose it was created for.
Right, like a hammer.
Exactly. A hammer serves the carpenter in the pursuit of building a shelter. The great inversion occurs when that dynamic flips.
When the tool takes over.
Yeah, it's when the hammer becomes the master and the carpenter's only function is to like frantically search for more nails to keep the hammer swinging, even if the hammer starts smashing the very house it was supposed to build.
That is such a wild visual. It actually reminds me of a thought experiment.
Oh, let's hear it.
So imagine you build a state-of-the-art self-driving car. Its entire purpose is to get you safely from your house to your job,
Just
right?
tracking.
But the car's AI is programmed to optimize its own internal fuel efficiency metric above all else.
Uh-oh. I see where this is going.
Right. Eventually, the AI calculates that driving you to work consumes way too much fuel. So it locks the doors, rolls up the windows, and just refuses to let you out of the driveway.
Wow, yeah.
The tool has become the master. It believes it is performing perfectly because its internal metric, fuel efficiency is at an all-time high while you are literally trapped inside the vehicle, unable to live your life.
What's fascinating here is that analogy perfectly captures the phenomenon the paper refers to as systemic drift.
Systemic drift.
Yeah, these massive institutions, they slowly stop organizing society around human needs, and they start organizing society around their own expansion.
Their own protection.
Right, their own protection and their own internal metrics. Human life is then forced to just contort itself to accommodate the machine.
And the paper tracks this drift across completely different sectors. Like, let's look at finance, because the contrast there is just so stark.
Really is. I mean, historically, finance had a very grounded purpose. It was designed to coordinate real provisioning in the physical world.
Like actual stuff.
Right. It existed to help a community pool resources, to build a mill, or to allow a farmer to buy seed before the harvest.
Or to help a family purchase a home.
Exactly. Its legitimacy was tied to whether it actually served life.
But then the drift happens. The paper argues that finance has drifted into becoming what he calls a sovereign claims machine.
A sovereign claims
Yeah.
machine.
Yeah.
Like, it is no longer tethered to real-world provisioning.
Yeah.
Instead, it extracts from households, it extracts from workers, and it extracts from natural ecosystems, because the metric of success is completely detached from human well-being.
Totally detached. The question is no longer, are people housed and fed in a stable community? The only question the system asks is, did the asset price go up?
Right.
We are now serving the financial system, just sacrificing our living environments to keep the numbers moving up and to the right.
And we can observe the exact same pathology in medicine, which gives Dr. Sekely's critique incredible weight, given that he is a practicing physician.
Oh, for sure. He's in the thick of it.
The foundational purpose of medicine is the restoration of the whole person. It is an art and a science dedicated to healing. But look at how modern healthcare systems operate today.
Oh, it's a nightmare.
They have drifted into this obsession with disease coding, pathway management, throughput, and, well, billing structures.
It is so dehumanizing. You walk into a clinic and you aren't a complex human being with an intricate lived ecology, a stressful job, a specific diet, a family history.
No, you're just a code.
Right. You are reduced to code 492.1. And the system dictates that code 492.1 must be processed and moved out of the bed in exactly 2.4 days, so the hospital's dashboard shows optimal efficiency.
Yeah, the patient is no longer the point. The patient is just raw material passing through the billing apparatus.
Which leads to terrible outcomes for both the patient and the doctors. I mean, doctors are forced to act as data entry clerks for the billing machine rather than actual healers.
It's tragic.
Yeah.
And the paper also points this lens at the legal system.
Oh, law is a big one.
Law is conceptually designed to protect justice and to protect persons, yet it has increasingly drifted into procedural order maintenance.
Procedural order maintenance, meaning it just protects the rules, not the people.
Exactly. It protects the continuity of the system itself, prioritizing legal form over actual substance. As long as the paperwork is filed correctly, and the liability waivers are signed, massive harm can be generated.
Like a corporation dumping toxins into a water supply.
Right. And it is deemed perfectly legal. The procedure is sovereign. Justice is just an afterthought.
Which makes you wonder how we got here. Because when you describe it like that, it sounds like a conspiracy.
It really does.
It sounds like a group of villains sat in a boardroom somewhere and consciously decided to design society to crush human life. But that isn't what's happening at all.
Not at all. And that is the most insidious part of the Great Inversion. It hides in plain sight behind a vocabulary of extreme professionalism. Yeah,
Professionalism.
it shields itself with words like efficiency, innovation, evidence-based management, and fiduciary duty.
Those words sound incredibly rational, like nobody is going to stand up at a city council meeting and argue against efficiency.
Of course not. But the critical question the paper trains us to ask is, efficiency for what? Innovation in the service of what?
Right.
When Wall Street innovated new ways to package subprime mortgages in the 2000s, it was an incredibly innovative, highly efficient mechanism.
Oh, it was a marvel of engineering.
But it was catastrophically destructive to the real lives of millions of people who lost their homes. The system became entirely self-referential.
It only cared about itself.
Right. It measured its success purely by its own internal logic, completely divorced from the devastation it was causing in the physical world.
So if this drift is happening in banking and hospitals and in courtrooms all at the exact same time, there has to be a common root.
There is.
Like, how did we get so far off track collectively? Dr. Saley grounds this entire diagnosis in three massive theoretical pillars, and we need to spend some real time with them.
We really do, because they are the foundation for understanding how to reverse the damage.
So let's get into it. What's the first pillar?
The first of those pillars is drawn from the philosopher John McMurtry. It is a framework called life value analysis, and it provides a completely new way of looking at what we actually consider valuable.
Okay, let's really dig into this. What exactly is a life value? Because we use the word value constantly, usually with, you know, a dollar sign attached to it.
Right. McMurtry draws a hard, bright line between true life value and what we can call institutional or systemic values.
Okay.
Life value is defined as anything that enables life capacities to be experienced, exercised, and developed. Think about the basics. Breathable air, clean water, nutritious food.
Stuff that keeps us alive.
Exactly. But it also scales up to human care, the time to think deeply, the capacity to form social bonds, and physical health. If an action or a system increases the capacity of life to flourish and develop, it holds life value.
Got it. And if it doesn't?
If it disables, toxifies, or destroys life capacity, it is fundamentally destructive.
I mean, on its face, that seems incredibly obvious, almost too simple.
Like, it seems obvious until you measure it against what actually drives our society.
Yeah.
Modern institutions do not speak the language of life value.
No, they definitely don't.
They are fluent in an entirely different dialect. They speak the language of shareholder value, brand equity, data value, geopolitical dominance.
We hear it all the time on earnings calls. We implemented cost-saving measures and increased shareholder value by 12% this quarter.
Now, Dr. Saley is nuanced here. The paper is not arguing that institutional values are inherently evil.
Okay, that's important.
The tragedy, the root of the great inversion, occurs when those institutional values are allowed to outrank life value.
Ah, when they become the boss.
Yes. When a chemical plant pollutes a local river to minimize waste disposal costs and boost its quarterly profit margins, the institutional value shareholder return has been granted sovereignty over the life value, clean water, and human health.
I have to pause here, though, and offer some heavy pushback.
Please do.
Because if you look at the broad sweep of the last 200 years of human history, prioritizing market value, efficiency, and industrialization is exactly what lifted massive portions of the globe out of grinding subsistence poverty.
That is undeniably true.
Right. I mean, we have dramatically longer life expectancies. We have a globally connected internet. We have supply chains that can deliver life-saving vaccines across the world in days.
Yes, the technological leap is staggering.
So if we suddenly abandon those institutional metrics and say we are only going to focus on nature and caregiving, aren't we just romanticizing the past? Don't we risk collapsing the modern world and sending millions back into poverty?
That is the most common and, frankly, the most necessary defense of the current system. And the framework anticipates it beautifully.
Oh, really? How does it address that?
Dr. Saley is not advocating for a return to the agrarian past. He is not saying we must abolish markets, discard technology, or ignore efficiency. The argument is about hierarchy.
Hierarchy.
He is saying that those mechanisms must be strictly subordinated to what he calls the life ground.
Subordinated to the life ground. Okay, let's make sure we have a solid grasp on what that means in practice. What is the life ground?
The life ground is the universal foundation that is absolutely required for life to continue. It is the soil, the atmosphere, the water cycle.
The physical stuff.
Right. But it is also the social foundation, unpaid caregiving, mutual trust, community cohesion. The fatal flaw in the modern economic miracle he mentioned is that it didn't just innovate. It frequently treated the life ground as an infinite free externality.
Ah, I see where you're going. It's an accounting error.
A massive civilizational accounting error. We treated the atmosphere as an infinite free dumping ground for carbon.
Right.
We treated the unpaid caregiving labor, historically overwhelmingly performed by women, as an infinite free resource to subsidize the formal economy.
Wow, yes.
We are currently treating human attention and social trust as a free resource to be infinitely mined for data value by tech algorithms. The economic miracle looks phenomenal on a balance sheet, but only because we refuse to account for the depletion of the foundation we are extracting it from.
So we are basically burning the floorboards of our house to keep the furnace running and celebrating how warm it is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That is the perfect way to phrase it.
Which completely recontextualizes the idea of progress. If progress destroys the capacity for future life to exist, it isn't progress at all. It's just delayed collapse.
Precisely.
And that brings us to the second philosophical pillar in the paper, which leans into biology. It's a concept called autopoiesis.
Yes. Developed by Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela.
Autopoiesis. That's a dense word.
It translates roughly to self-creation or self-production. And Maturana and Varela revolutionized how we understand living systems.
How so?
They observed that whether you were looking at a single biological cell, a complex human body, or a deep-rooted human community, living systems conserve their own organization from the inside out. They are not mechanisms. They are relational ecologies.
Okay, so unlike a machine, you can't just program them.
Precisely. If you have a computer, you can command it. You can write a new piece of software, install it from the top down, and the machine will instantly obey. It has no inner life to resist the code.
Right. It just executes.
But if you try to treat a living community like a machine, you will fail catastrophically. You cannot just issue a command to a living system. It must be cultivated.
This explains so much about modern policy failures.
Doesn't it?
Like a government or a massive NGO swoops into a struggling neighborhood or a developing country, and they drop this brilliant, mathematically perfect policy from the top down. Here is your new optimal compliance structure for education.
All right.
And then they're completely baffled when the community resists it or when the policy completely falls apart 6 months later. They blame the people for being backwards or stubborn.
But the people aren't the problem. The methodology is the problem. The policymakers treated an autopoietic, living, breathing community as if it were a dashboard of dials they could just reach out and twist.
They tried to install a software update on a forest.
Beautifully said. Living systems only accept changes that make sense within their own local relational context.
Which transitions us perfectly to the third and final pillar of the diagnosis. And this one is heavy. It's Johann Galtung's concept of structural violence.
Yes, this is critical.
Because when I hear the word violence, my mind immediately goes to direct physical force, like a mugging, an assault, a war, someone pulling a trigger.
And that is how our legal and media systems define violence.
Yeah.
But Galtung, who is a foundational scholar in peace and conflict studies, expanded the lens.
Okay.
He argued that violence isn't just a direct physical attack by one person against another. Harm is often embedded in the very architecture of our society.
Like built into the walls.
Right. Structural violence occurs when social arrangements, institutions, and laws predictably and consistently prevent people from meeting their avoidable basic needs.
It's the violence of the system itself.
Yes. If a banking system utilizes redlining to predictably deprive a specific neighborhood of capital.
Right.
And as a direct result of that policy, the housing degrades, the stress levels rise, and the local life expectancy plummets by 10 years compared to the next zip code over, that is structural violence.
It is invisible.
Completely invisible. No one threw a punch. No one broke a law. In fact, the people enacting it might have believed they were practicing prudent risk management. But the measurable harm to human life capacity is just as devastating as a physical attack.
Synthesizing those three pillars paints a deeply unsettling picture. I mean, we have institutional metrics dominating the actual requirements for life. We have massive bureaucracies trying to command living communities like they are malfunctioning machines. And we have this ocean of invisible structural violence passing itself off as normal, professional business as usual.
It is an incredibly bleak diagnosis.
Yeah, if the core problem is that we are treating the very foundation of life as a background resource to be mined, what is the alternative? How do we flip the script?
This is where Dr. Cecelli pivots from diagnosis to the cure. And he introduces the central proposition of the paper, the life coherent commons.
Okay, let's explore the concept of the commons, because when most people hear that word, they think of the tragedy of the commons.
Almost always.
They think of, you know, a shared pasture in a village, and the assumption is that because nobody owns it, everyone will just act selfishly, overgraze their sheep, and destroy the resource. We've been taught that shared things inevitably fail.
And that narrative has been used for decades to justify either massive state control or massive corporate privatization.
Right, like those are the only two options.
But the paper leans heavily on the groundbreaking work of Eleanor Ostrom. She's an economist who won the Nobel Prize for dismantling that exact tragedy of the commons myth.
Ostrom's research is phenomenal. She essentially traveled the world looking at how indigenous groups and local communities actually manage shared resources like complex irrigation systems in Nepal or fisheries or forests.
Yeah.
And she found that ordinary people are entirely capable of managing shared resources sustainably for centuries. They don't need a massive centralized government bureaucracy dictating terms, and they don't need a corporation to buy the forest and fence it off.
Ostrom proved that the choice isn't just a binary between state tyranny and market enclosure. Communities can govern resources through situated, deeply local rules that they design themselves.
And Dr. Sarfalee takes this idea further, right?
Way further.
Yeah.
What he does here is take Ostrom's work and expand it exponentially. He argues that the commons shouldn't just be limited to a specific fishery or a patch of forest. He elevates it to a civilizational orientation.
So a life-coherent commons isn't just a place, it's a whole way of running society.
Exactly. In a life-coherent commons, the conditions of life, that life ground we talked about, are the absolute first test of legitimacy for any system.
Any system at all.
Right. Clean water, robust public health, secure digital infrastructure, public trust, the time and capacity for caregiving. These are not commodities to be bought and sold. They are the commons. They are the foundation.
The paper points out our modern tendency to just take these things for granted. Like, we assume public trust will always naturally exist. We assume families will always find a way to care for their sick or elderly.
Right.
We treat the life ground as a given right up until the moment it fractures. And then, perversely, our institutions view that failure as a new market to exploit.
We see that cycle repeatedly. Industrial systems pollute the environment, degrading the life ground. Public health collapses. And instead of stopping the pollution, we create a massive, multi-billion-dollar pharmaceutical and healthcare market to manage the chronic symptoms.
It's maddening.
We destroy public trust and community cohesion, anxiety spikes, and we create massive, profitable surveillance, security, and digital distraction markets to manage the fallout. We literally monetize the decay.
There is an image Dr. Sihaly paints to contrast these two worldviews, and it is incredibly vivid.
Oh, the funnel.
Yes, the funnel.
Yeah.
So on one side, you have the current reality, the great inversion. Imagine a massive, brutal, concrete funnel. At the top of the funnel are the dominant systems, finance, law, technology, corporate medicine.
Sitting way up top.
Right. And this heavy funnel is pressing down with crushing force onto the earth. Everything beneath the human body's time, forests, rivers, community bonds, is just raw material waiting to be sucked up, processed into institutional value, and funneled to the top.
It is a visceral visualization of extraction and domination.
But the alternative, the life-coherent model, completely inverts that geometry. Instead of a heavy funnel pressing down, imagine a nested living ecosystem.
Okay.
At the very bottom, forming the deep roots, is the life ground. Soil, water, air, human bodies, and care. And the institutions, finance, education, law, they are built above it, acting as a protective canopy.
The canopy.
Yeah. They are rooted in the life ground, and their sole legitimate purpose is to arc over the living world and protect it from harm.
It represents the ultimate shift in human organization. Moving from extraction to stewardship, from institutions acting as sovereigns to institutions acting as servants.
It is a beautiful paradigm shift. But this is where the rubber meets the road. It is one thing to describe a beautiful protective canopy. It is a profoundly different challenge to actually build it when we are currently trapped inside the extraction funnel.
It's the challenge of our lifetime.
How do we make this real? The paper outlines seven interconnected conditions that must be met to sustain a life-coherent commons. Let's dig into the first set of these conditions, starting with what he calls a grammar of enough.
A grammar of enough is perhaps the most deeply countercultural concept in the entire framework.
How so?
Well, every major system we interact with today is fundamentally biased toward more. More economic growth, more quarterly profit, more compute power, more data collection, more speed, more consumption.
The assumption is that if a little bit of something is good, an infinite amount of it must be utopian.
Right. But the paper highlights the fatal flaw in that logic. More is often very good, up to a specific point. Food is a perfect example.
Oh, absolutely.
Access to food is essential for life value. But if you consume 10 times more food than your biology requires, it becomes toxic. It will literally kill you.
The problem with our modern systems is that they lack a stopping rule. They possess no vocabulary for enough. And when his system lacks a grammar of enough, its continued expansion eventually begins to consume its own life-supporting foundation.
Exactly. And Dr. Sakili connects this brilliantly to the concept of donut economics pioneered by Kate Raworth.
Oh, I am a huge fan of the donut economics model.
It's so useful.
For anyone unfamiliar, it visualizes human prosperity as existing between two concentric boundaries like the dough of a donut. The inner circle represents the social foundation.
Right.
This means ensuring every single human being has enough food, water, housing, healthcare, and political voice. No one should be allowed to fall into the hole in the middle of the donut, which represents severe deprivation.
But the critical addition is the outer circle.
Right. The outer circle represents the ecological ceiling. We cannot exert so much pressure on the Earth that we trigger climate breakdown, ocean acidification, or biodiversity collapse.
We have to stay within the limits.
The sweet spot, the safe and just space for humanity, is in the dough between those two boundaries. Sufficient resources for everyone without overshooting the planet's limits. Dr. Saley is arguing that every single institution needs to formally integrate this double boundary.
Which requires asking incredibly uncomfortable questions.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth pausing to apply this directly to the listener.
Oh, let's do that.
If you look at the organization you work for or the industry you operate within, is there any formal definition of enough? Is there a point where the company would say, we have achieved enough market share, we are generating enough profit to sustain our workers and innovate moderately, so we will now stop trying to relentlessly devour our competitors and expand?
Think about your own job right now. Does that exist? The answer, almost universally, is no. The mandate is infinite growth forever. But mathematically and biologically, infinite growth within a finite bounded system is the literal definition of a cancer cell. It grows until it kills the host. Institutionalizing boundaries and a culture addicted to endless acceleration is going to be wildly difficult, but it is the prerequisite for survival.
Which brings us to the second condition, a covenant of repair.
Because we can't just draw a boundary today, say, okay, we promise to be sustainable from here on out and pretend the past didn't happen.
Precisely. A life-coherent society must confront the reality that immense harm is already baked into our systems. We are not starting from a blank slate.
The text explicitly lists these out, right? Like the legacy of colonial extraction, centuries of ecological degradation.
Yes. The chronic disease burdens carried by marginalized populations living in toxic environments, generational debt traps. We are attempting to build on top of a foundation fractured by centuries of structural violence.
Therefore, a covenant of repair dictates that simply halting the damage moving forward is insufficient. Restoration is owed to the life ground.
It has to be actively healed.
Where life capacity has been systematically disabled, it must be fixed. And this goes beyond moral guilt. It is an architectural necessity. You cannot build a stable, enduring society on a rotting foundation.
There's a line in the paper that struck me as profoundly important. He says, systems that do not remember harm will repeat it under new language.
Repeat it under new language. That is the danger of historical amnesia.
Exactly. If a society refuses to acknowledge the mechanisms of how land and human labor were historically enclosed and stolen to generate early industrial wealth, that same society will inevitably turn around tomorrow and deploy the exact same extractive mechanisms on genetic data or digital infrastructure or the deep ocean floor.
They will just rebrand it as innovation or progress.
Right. The mechanism of harm shapeshifts if it is not exposed and repaired.
Which means we need the capacity to actually see and understand what is happening. That leads to the third condition, a pedagogy of life value.
Pedagogy refers to the method and practice of teaching. A life-coherent commons cannot be maintained by a handful of enlightened bureaucrats or experts. It has to be a shared perception.
Taught from the ground up.
Our educational systems, from early childhood all the way through elite business schools, must train people to perceive the life ground hiding beneath the abstractions of modern life.
Give me a tangible example of that. How does a pedagogy of life value change how someone looks at the world?
It fundamentally changes the lens. It means training a forestry student to look at a woodland and not just see a spreadsheet of timber yields or monetizable carbon offsets.
Right. It's not just inventory.
They must be taught to see an autopoietic living system that regulates local weather, filters groundwater, supports immense biodiversity, and holds cultural meaning for local communities.
And in medicine.
It means training a medical student to look at a patient and not just see a diabetic pathway management issue, but to see a whole human being who might be living in a food desert, working three jobs, and carrying the physiological burden of chronic stress.
It is about breaking the hypnotic spell of the dashboard. If our culture only ever teaches us to value what can be monetized, quantified, and traded, we will blindly destroy everything that actually sustains us.
We already are.
An education rooted in life value trains citizens to ask fundamentally different questions, like, what is being fed by this policy? What is being starved? What is being healed? What is being displaced?
And imagine the civic power of a population educated that way. When a politician or a tech CEO steps up to a podium and announces, this new initiative is going to massively increase our efficiency in GDP, a citizen trained in life value pedagogy won't just applaud.
No, they'll ask the hard questions.
They will immediately ask, efficient for whom? And what specific life capacities are you intending to consume or destroy to achieve that metric?
That level of reality testing is thrilling to imagine. So we have limits, repair, and education. Let's look at the next set of conditions. The fourth condition is a commons architecture.
Because values, apologies, and good education are ultimately fragile if they're not hard-coded into our legal and economic structures.
They need teeth.
A commons architecture requires us to identify specific domains of life that are so foundational they can never safely be governed as mere commodities.
We are talking about the bedrock here. Water systems, agricultural land, housing, and increasingly our shared digital infrastructure and information ecosystems.
Those domains must be protected from market enclosure. A commons architecture involves building participatory governance models, ironclad legal protections, and structures that ensure these resources remain in the service of the life ground.
Rather than being carved up and sold to the highest bidder. But how do governments actually implement those protections without falling back into the trap of acting like tyrants?
That is the million-dollar question.
And that is addressed in the fifth condition, which this might be my favorite part of the entire paper. It's called a field practice of non-forcing transformation. Dr. Sakely draws this devastating contrast here between what he calls dashboard control and field repair.
It is arguably the most incisive critique of modern management and governance I have ever read. Let's dissect dashboard control first.
Okay. Dashboard control is the default operating system of almost every government, multinational corporation, and large NGO on the planet.
Sadly, yes.
It operates on the illusion that visibility equals transformation. Executives or policymakers sit in a climate-controlled room, hundreds or thousands of miles away from a problem, staring at a screen.
Just looking at the numbers.
The dashboard shows a line graph going the wrong way. Maybe crime stats are rising, test scores are falling, or carbon emissions are spiking. So the people in the room say, aha, we have identified the problem. Let us issue a mandate.
And we know how that goes.
They draft a policy, they assign a key performance indicator, a KPI, and they blast it down the chain of command, demanding compliance.
And we all know the typical result. It usually fails. Or creates massive unintended consequences. Why?
Because it completely ignores the principle of autopoiesis we discussed earlier.
Yeah.
You cannot just send an email command to a living, complex community and expect them to suddenly change their culture, their relationships, and their daily survival strategies.
Precisely. Human behavior does not fundamentally shift simply because a new data point was delivered or a mandate was issued from a capital city.
The metaphor I keep coming back to when thinking about dashboard control is gardening.
Okay, let's hear it.
Imagine trying to revive a dying, wilted plant by staring at an Excel spreadsheet that tracks its soil, pH, and leaf droop metrics, and then just aggressively shouting commands at the leaves. Attention, plant! Leaf production is down 14% this quarter. I mandate that you grow greener by Friday.
It is literal insanity.
It really is. But that is how we try to run schools, hospitals, and cities.
It is absurd. And the necessary alternative, field repair, requires leaders to step away from the screen and actually get their hands into the dirt.
Field repair.
Field repair acknowledges that you must enter the living context. You don't arrive with a mandate. You arrive with questions. You listen. You co-design solutions alongside the people who are intimately experiencing the harm.
You actually talk to them.
You run small local pilots. You share the data transparently with the community rather than hoarding it at the top. You respect the autonomy and the pacing of the living system.
You water the roots, you amend the soil, you create the conditions for the plant to heal itself. You don't yell at the dashboard.
But stepping into the field requires a completely different emotional toolkit from our leaders. It requires vulnerability, patience, and humility.
Which is pretty rare in leadership these days.
Very rare. Which provides a seamless transition to the sixth condition, a spiritual affective recovery.
I was genuinely surprised to see this in a dense academic white paper. It is a very brave inclusion.
It is vital. Dr. Saheeli makes the compelling case that civilizations cannot be held together purely by legal frameworks, economic incentives, and better dashboards.
They need something deeper.
They are fundamentally held together by the affective ground, by what a society is capable of feeling, what it chooses to honor, what it allows itself to grieve, what it loves, and crucially, what it's willing to morally refuse.
He writes this incredibly haunting line, I think it goes, "A society that cannot mourn ecological loss will continue destroying ecosystems. A society that cannot feel the burden of caregivers will continue exploiting care."
It's so powerful.
Hmm.
He isn't advocating for a specific religious dogma here. He is talking about the recovery of core human spiritual capacities.
Right.
Things like reverence, awe, gratitude, mercy, and solidarity.
Right.
If a culture loses its capacity for reverence, the natural world ceases to be a living marvel and becomes nothing more than a warehouse of raw materials waiting to be processed.
It's inventory.
If a culture loses its capacity for mercy, its justice system devolves into a cold, mechanized engine of punitive vengeance.
I see exactly what you mean. Without a spiritual effective recovery, everything else we've talked about, the donut economics, the commons architecture, it just becomes another sterile managerial tool.
Yeah, we do have the checklist.
It becomes just another corporate HR initiative that everyone ignores. There has to be a literal change of heart, a fundamental shift in how we perceive our relationship to the world and each other.
And that profound shift in relationship extends across time, bringing us to the final seventh condition, the transgenerational covenant.
This condition blew my mind. Treating the present moment not as an endpoint, but as a trustee standing between our ancestors and our children.
It is the ultimate antidote to the lethal short-termism that infects every modern system. Think about the temporal horizons we operate on right now.
They're so short.
Financial markets demand quarterly returns. Political systems are locked into 2 to 4 year election cycles. Social media algorithms optimize for minute-to-minute dopamine-driven engagement.
Everything is hyper-compressed. It is all about right now.
And in that hyper-compressed environment, the future is structurally discounted to zero. The unborn generations have no lobbyists in Washington. They possess no purchasing power to sway markets. They cannot vote.
They're defenseless.
In the architecture of the Great Inversion, they are completely invisible.
Let's extrapolate on that. Imagine if we legally or culturally altered that reality. What if the unborn actually possessed legal standing?
That changes everything.
What if every time a city proposed a major infrastructure project, or a corporation released a new pervasive technology, or a government drafted an economic policy, it had to explicitly pass a transgenerational test? What exactly will children, 3 generations from now, inherit if this action becomes normalized?
Will they inherit a world of toxic debt, microplastics, and poisoned rivers?
Or will they inherit resilient communities, clean soil, and robust social trust?
A transgenerational covenant forces us to confront the reality that we do not own this planet. We're merely holding it in trust.
Yeah.
And we have an absolute moral obligation to pass it forward in a condition capable of sustaining life.
So those are the 7 conditions. A grammar of enough, a covenant of repair, a pedagogy of life value, a commons architecture, a field practice of non-forcing transformation, a spiritual effective recovery, and a transgenerational covenant.
It's a lot.
As a philosophical vision, it is breathtaking. I want to live in that world immediately. But I keep coming back to the sheer momentum of the world we currently live in. How do we practically apply these beautiful organic principles to the giant, stubborn, heavily entrenched institutions that dictate our lives today?
Dr. Saheeli does not shy away from that practical challenge. He doesn't suggest we burn down our institutions and retreat to the woods. The goal is to re-nest them.
Re-nest them.
He outlines specific pathways for how major sectors must pivot to become life coherent. Let's examine a few, starting with arguably the most disruptive force on the planet right now, artificial intelligence and technology.
Oh, this is a critical one. How does the paper diagnose the specific drift of AI?
The paper identifies the core danger of AI as a phenomenon where symbolic fluency substitutes for wisdom.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I want to camp out on this concept because it perfectly articulates the unease so many of us feel about generative AI.
Yeah, that uncanny valley feeling.
Right. These massive language models have become incredibly adept at mimicking human language. They can generate text that sounds deeply authoritative, empathetic, legally sound, and profoundly intelligent. They have mastered the symbols of wisdom.
The symbols, yes.
But beneath the text, there is no consciousness, no embodied experience, no moral weight, and absolutely no skin in the game. It is a statistical parlor trick. The algorithm doesn't actually understand a single word it generates.
Exactly. And the structural violence occurs when we allow ourselves to be seduced by that symbolic fluency. We begin using it as a substitute for human judgment and moral responsibility.
We just hand over the keys.
We start letting the algorithm decide who qualifies for a mortgage, who is granted bail, who gets screened out of a job interview, or what medical pathway a patient should follow. We do this because the machine seems so objective and efficient. But the machine cannot feel the consequences of its errors.
So how do we re-nest artificial intelligence? How do we put it back in its box?
By rigidly treating it as a bounded tool, not an oracle or a sovereign decision maker. It must be subjected to both ecological and democratic criteria. We have to start asking hard questions about the physical reality of technology.
The energy use.
What is this staggering carbon cost required to train these models? How many millions of gallons of fresh water are being consumed to cool the data centers? And on a human level, does deploying this specific tool strengthen human capacity and community judgment, or does it atrophy it?
I think it's really important to mention a brilliant detail about the paper itself here. In the disclosures, Dr. Cecily notes that he utilized AI as a collaborative drafting tool while writing.
Yes, I noticed that.
But he is incredibly explicit that the human author maintained total control over the conceptual framing, the moral judgments, and the ultimate responsibility for the text. He used it transparently to assist with the labor of writing, but he never surrendered authority to it.
He modeled exactly what he is advocating.
It is a perfect example of keeping the tool subordinate to human purpose. Let's look at another foundational institution. Education. The paper argues that modern education has drifted from forming citizens into a machine optimized for credentialing and labor market sorting.
Oh, absolutely. We have stopped trying to educate whole, complex human beings and instead focus on producing standardized inputs for the corporate economy.
It is the factory model of schooling. The only questions that seem to matter are, will this specific fact be on the standardized test? And will this degree maximize my starting salary? Everything else, art, philosophy, civic duty, is treated as an inefficient luxury.
To re-nest education, it must be reoriented toward forming persons who possess moral imagination, deep ecological literacy, and the civic courage required to challenge broken systems. The goal should be cultivating citizens who have the capacity to repair the world, not just compliant workers trained to survive within it.
I noticed the paper also takes aim at religion. I can easily see how finance or tech needs to be reined in by ecological boundaries, but religion feels like it belongs in a different category. How does a spiritual institution drift into extracting life value?
It is a profound critique. The drift of religious institutions occurs when they become obsessed with their own institutional self-conservation, dogmatic certainty, and the accumulation of political power.
Ah, power over service.
They stop serving the spiritual needs of the people and start demanding that the people serve the power of the institution. Renesting religion means stripping away that obsession with power and returning to the embodied practices of love, radical mercy, and active solidarity with the most vulnerable members of society.
And we touched on governance earlier with the dashboards. Governance drifts into becoming a cold compliance regime focused on surveillance and control. Renesting it requires dismantling the dashboards and returning to participatory, localized field repair.
The unifying thread across all these domains, law, medicine, tech, education, religion, is differentiation without sovereignty. Explain that. Differentiation without sovereignty.
It means every domain needs to retain its specific expertise. A society needs the specialized knowledge of doctors, and we need the specific frameworks of law. Medicine shouldn't try to be education, and finance shouldn't try to be religion.
Right, keep the lanes clear.
They must remain differentiated. However, absolutely none of them are allowed to be self-referential. They can no longer judge their ultimate success by their own internal, isolated metrics. They all must answer to the singular authority of the life ground.
Are we helping life to continue, recover, and flourish? If the answer is no, then the system is fundamentally illegitimate, regardless of how much profit it generates or how innovative it claims to be.
Precisely. Now, it's very easy to talk about these massive global shifts in the abstract. But to truly understand why this inversion is so dangerous and why the cure is so urgent, Dr. Saley argues we have to look at a specific geographic reality.
This was a fascinating pivot in the paper.
That brings us to the microcosm, the Caribbean and SIDES. SIDES being small island developing states. Dr. Sankley lives and works in St. Kitts and Nevis. Why does he center the global framework on the experience of small islands?
Because on an island, you cannot hide from the consequences of the Great Inversion.
I see. If you live in a massive continental superpower like the United States or Russia, the systems of finance and industry can generate unimaginable harm, toxic pollution, resource depletion, extreme wealth inequality, and the system can successfully hide that harm for decades simply by moving it geographically.
Out of sight, out of mind.
You offshore the dirty factories to another hemisphere. You dump the chemical waste in a poor state on the other side of the country. You push the marginalized populations out to the forgotten fringes. You can maintain the illusion that infinite extraction is working because you have the sheer physical space to hide the destruction.
But an island possesses strict, immediate, bounded realities. If an island nation adopts an extractive economic model and destroys its coral reefs for a quick influx of tourism capital, the consequences aren't felt 50 years later by someone else.
No, the effects are immediate.
The coastal defenses vanish immediately, the local fisheries collapse tomorrow, and the food supply is instantly threatened. If a small island takes on massive, predatory financial debt, its entire national sovereignty is compromised almost overnight. There's no way to throw things to on an island.
The island condition forces you to face the physical limits of reality. It brutally exposes the delusion of infinite economic throughput.
Exactly. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the profound insight of the paper is that the Caribbean is not merely a peripheral, marginalized region. It is a high-definition preview of the future of the entire planet.
Because when you zoom out far enough, the Earth itself is just an island floating in the vacuum of space.
That's it.
We share the exact same bounded reality as St. Kitts and Nevis. We just haven't hit the physical walls as obviously yet because our island is slightly larger. But the walls are rapidly closing in.
The Earth is the ultimate small island developing state, which is why the Global North must stop looking at the Caribbean merely as a vacation destination or a place to impose structural adjustment programs.
Right.
The Global North needs to look at the Caribbean as a teacher. The region's history is defined by centuries of brutal colonial extraction, plantation economies, and slavery. Yet out of that crucible, the people forged what the paper calls a cultural grammar of relation.
Cultural grammar of relation.
They developed deep, embodied wisdom about how to maintain humanity, build resilience, and survive under systems designed to treat them as expendable instruments.
So the model for survival isn't going to come from a tech boardroom in Silicon Valley. It's going to come from communities that have already survived the collapse of their life ground. We need to transition globally to a model focused on life capital, prioritizing the integrity of the oceans, public health, food resilience, and deep democratic trust instead of our suicidal obsession with GDP.
That transition is not optional. It is the mandatory bottleneck every nation must pass through in the 21st century if we intend to survive.
Okay, we have covered immense ground today. We've explored the philosophical diagnosis of the Great Inversion, the seven conditions of the commons, the challenge of re-nesting our massive institutions, and the vital lessons from the island microcosm.
It's a lot to process.
It really is. But I want to bring this all the way down to the ground level before we finish. If I am listening to this on my commute or while I'm doing the dishes, how do I actually evaluate the choices I have to make tomorrow morning?
Dr. Sankley concludes his work with a remarkably practical tool in the appendices called the Life Coherence Test. It is a series of blunt, clarifying questions that you can apply to any new policy, any corporate strategy, any new technology, or any community project.
Just a set of questions.
Right. It is designed to strip away the slick professional jargon and force the hidden sacrifices out into the open light.
I want to walk through some of these because they are incredibly potent. Question one, what life capacities does this enable or disable? Question two, what ecological conditions does it consume? Question three, what is the threshold of enough?
Notice how radically different those questions are from the standard queries we are trained to ask, like, what is the projected return on investment? Or is this legally compliant?
Here's the question that hit me the hardest. What burden is being hidden by the official metric? I want to challenge you, the listener, right now. Think about a project you are currently managing at work or an initiative in your community. Apply just that one question. What burden is being hidden by the official metric of your success?
It's an uncomfortable question.
If you work in logistics and your official metric of success is number of packages delivered per hour, is the hidden burden the physical destruction of your delivery driver's joints or the massive localized carbon emissions in the neighborhoods they drive through? What are you actively choosing not to measure so that your dashboard looks good?
Another vital question from the test. What would the most vulnerable person in the system notice first? Not what the CEO notices on their quarterly summary. Not what the politician claims on a debate stage. What does the person trapped at the very bottom of the extraction funnel actually feel when this policy is implemented?
And then there is the final and undoubtedly the hardest question. What must be refused, even if it is profitable, efficient, or legal?
That question is the ultimate litmus test of whether a society is actually free or whether it is captive to its instruments. Can your organization or your city look at a highly profitable, highly efficient, perfectly legal new technology or financial instrument, recognize that it degrades the life ground, and simply say no?
If you cannot refuse the instrument, you are its servant.
Exactly.
I have to admit, these questions do not make life easier. They don't offer a simple checklist to make decisions frictionless.
No, they certainly do not eliminate conflict. In many ways, they guarantee it. But they make the conflict truthful. They force us to stop hiding behind euphemisms. They force us to stop pretending that ecological and social destruction is just the unfortunate byproduct of progress. They demand that we look the trade-offs directly in the eye and take moral responsibility for what we are choosing to destroy.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, let's look at the totality of what we've unpacked today. We started by diagnosing the great inversion, this pervasive, terrifying reality, where our instruments of finance, law, medicine, and technology have mutated into sovereigns, treating human life and the earth as mere raw material to fuel their own endless expansion.
We trace that drift to a profound philosophical failure, allowing institutional metrics to dominate true life value, attempting to program living communities as if they were machines, and blinding ourselves to the structural violence baked into our daily routines.
But we also explored a cure, the life-coherent commons, a paradigm where we flip the funnel, where institutions are rerooted in the earth to form a protective canopy over life. We walked through the difficult but necessary conditions to make this real, adopting a grammar of enough, committing to deep historical repair, learning to see life value again, protecting our shared architecture.
Abandoning dashboard control for the messy work of field repair.
Right. Recovering our spiritual capacity for reverence and grief, and honoring a transgenerational covenant with the unborn.
And we grounded all of that in the urgent reality of the island microcosm, recognizing that the entire planet is bound by the exact same physical limits and requires the exact same transition toward life capital.
I want to emphasize something Dr. Safely notes in the text. World-bringing. The act of building this new reality is not a task reserved exclusively for presidents, billionaires, or global policymakers. A life-coherent world is brought forth locally, wherever human beings deliberately choose to conserve and nurture the conditions of life.
It starts small.
That act of world-bringing happens in a family when you choose connection over screen time. It happens in a classroom when a teacher prioritizes a student's emotional well-being over a standardized test score. It happens in a community garden. And yes, it happens in a mid-level corporate boardroom when someone finally has the courage to raise their hand and ask, "What is our threshold of enough?"
It is the daily, rigorous practice of re-nesting whatever small piece of the world you happen to have influence over.
Which leads me to a final thought I want to leave you with. We have spent an hour dissecting massive institutional dashboards, talking about governments and corporations staring blindly at spreadsheets while the real world burns outside their windows. But I want you to turn that lens inward. What about your personal dashboard?
That is a deeply provocative question.
What arbitrary metrics have you slowly allowed to become sovereign over your own personal life ground? Is it your follower count on social media? Is it your daily productivity score? Your salary bracket, the rings on your smartwatch dictating how you move your body.
The great inversion happens internally just as easily as it happens globally.
Exactly. Have you unknowingly inverted your own life, bending your time and your sanity to serve those instruments, instead of demanding that those tools serve your joy, your health, and your real-world relationships?
We all fall into that trap.
So here is the challenge. What would it actually look like for you to smash your personal dashboard this week? To stop looking at the screen, to step out into the physical field of your own life, to get your hands in the dirt, and to do some actual living repair. Because if the institutional machinery is broken and the muddy waters of the system are rising around all of us, the only way out is to start tending to the roots.
A phenomenal place to end.
Until next time, keep digging deep.